Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There were a lot of old headlines in the news this September 11th. Those headlines, of course, but also the ones from 5 years ago this week. The ones that said Lehman Brothers struggles and pressure builds. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 11th of September. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. This is a day, of course, to look back to the events of 12 years ago and what they meant, but also to the early fall of 2008 and the start of a month or two in the life of the American economy that we are still dealing with. So today and the rest of the week on the broadcast, where we are 5 years after the fall of Lehman Brothers, what it meant for Wall Street, and what it meant for the rest of us.
Hi, I'm Neil Raper. I worked for a company in Totowa, New Jersey called Custom Index. Their main claim to fame was making tabs. You know, those things that you put into three-ring binders as dividers? Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and Goldman Sachs all had literally tons of custom stock in our warehouse. I mean, our warehouse was huge. You have no idea. A Lehman Brothers stock alone was like 20 tons. And it's just tabs. It's not even the print. It's the tabs. What used to be a full workload for three shifts of pressmen became 75%, then 50%. Then I was let go with 300 other people. I had been in the industry for 19 years and weathered several recessions, but this one was going to be the last nail. Not being able to get a job in print, I moved to Kentucky to live with my mom, where unemployment was already on the rise. I'm currently going to college to retool in a new career and taking an amazing amount of debt to do it. In short, I'd say I'm just a typical working stiff, squeezed out of the lower middle class. Nothing to see here. Please move on.
Neil Raper, 5 years on. I kind of love that piece, all those tabs sitting in that warehouse. We will have more about the legacy of Lehman Brothers later on in the broadcast. On Wall Street today, a split decision. Details, numbers, you know the drill. The use of military force in Syria is, at least for now, off the table. The president said as much in his speech last night. Wait and see are now the watchwords about Bashar al-Assad and his chemical weapons and whether or not he will actually give them up. But gathering them and eventually destroying them might just be easier said than done. Philip Bleek worked on nonproliferation in the Pentagon. He teaches it now. Mr. Bleek, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
How's this going to work then? We're going to go in and get these chemical weapons and take care of them?
The logistics of this are extraordinarily challenging. So I think this is something that President Obama should pursue to see where it goes. But it's a little bit hard, actually, from my position to see how the logistics of this even play out.
Do you imagine the people with the expertise in this, with the professional experience, that is the American Army and the Russian Army, do you imagine them working together on the ground in Syria?
Certainly one can imagine scenarios where the U.S. and the Russians collaborated. I should note that while one could imagine there being U.S. military personnel involved, a lot of the personnel that would do this would be contractors.
Do you imagine this being an expensive proposition?
Yes and no. I think it doesn't have to be as expensive as, for example, the effort to destroy U.S. and Russian munitions, which was, and chemical weapons stocks, which was extraordinarily expensive. I think the U.S. is estimated to spend a little bit more than $30 billion in total on destroying its very large stockpile. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be that expensive, but it's unlikely to be cheap.
Hazard a guess for me.
I would think it would be probably in total in the hundreds of millions of dollars, realistically. I have a hard time picturing it being much less than that. Hopefully it wouldn't be much more than that. That said, the possibility of destroying one of the largest active chemical weapons stockpiles in the world is worth a lot to us.
It strikes me that these things are reasonably cheap to produce, these kinds of weapons, and yet incredibly expensive to destroy.
I think that's right. I mean, we sometimes call chemical weapons the poor man's atomic bomb, and they are certainly far cheaper to produce and maintain than, for example, nuclear weapons, which are quite costly. But destroying them, in particular destroying them in the way that we have in the United States, which has to meet certain health and environmental and other requirements, is quite costly.
And one assumes you'd want to be as careful and safe as possible over there, too.
Certainly, and you would also need to be treaty compliant. For example, the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which implements the Chemical Weapons Convention, prohibits you from crude destruction such as burning in open pits or dumping into the sea, which, believe it or not, was done a lot historically, including by the United States.
I was just going to say, probably by us.
Yes.
How are we going to know that we've gotten them all?
We're not.
Say that again.
We are not going to know that we've gotten them all. And in fact, the Libyan case is a little bit of an analog to this. So Gaddafi had a modest chemical weapons stockpile, and he declared that as part of a process of opening up to the West. And it turns out that he held a little back, which we found after the fact, or some of his military commanders held a little back. That said, if you can destroy 95% or 99% or whatever it might be of the Syrian stockpile, that's worth a lot, even if there's a little that we don't initially find.
Hmm. Philip Bleek teaches nonproliferation at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He worked professionally in that field at the Pentagon until not too long ago. Mr. Bleek, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
There's a new study out showing the gap between rich and poor Americans is wider than it has been in years. 100 years, actually, is how far back you'd have to go to find so much wealth so concentrated at the top. But there is also a key difference between now and the Gilded Age. More of today's one percenters are working, the working rich, they're called. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Take yourself back to 1913. The robber barons had accumulated vast fortunes. They didn't have to work, but they did have to start paying income taxes that year. The new study from Berkeley and the Paris School of Economics analyzed tax returns for the past 100 years and found that more of today's uber-rich are working stiffs. Austin Nichols is an economist at the Urban Institute.
Now the typical one percenter might be running a company and earning a lot of salary instead of just earning the returns on capital.
So how are the rest of us affected when more one percenters work? Does more of their wealth trickle down? There are a few theories on that. Gary Bertlis has one. He's an economist at the Brookings Institution. He says there's no trickle down, and during tough times, companies may cut back so they can keep paying their working rich CEOs.
They want to protect the high incomes and wages of their key officers, and they may do so at the expense of workers who are less well paid.
But things are different if you're talking about a creative entrepreneur who made it rich and is still innovating, according to Harry Holzer, who teaches public policy at Georgetown.
Companies that are innovating a lot, they often do create a lot of jobs compared to the companies that are just standing still.
The catch? Those jobs may be overseas. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Just because the theme of today's show is a little bit back to the future, what with Lehman Brothers and all that, here's another item. Back when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California in the early 1970s, he signed what became a landmark environmental law, the California Environmental Quality Act, it was called, CEQA for short. Anybody who wants to build anything big in California has to deal with CEQA, and critics have complained for decades that it hurts development and costs jobs. So this week, the state legislature out here might have a whack at changing it. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
The idea behind CEQA, which was groundbreaking in 1970, is to force developers to figure out and make public how their project might hurt the environment and do something about it. The Sierra Club's Catherine Phillips.
In a nutshell, it's a process.
A long, annoying process, say critics, and one that's ripe for abuse. Everybody from labor unions to rival developers to NIMBYs has used the law to either stop projects or extract concessions. Even some of California's passionate environmentalists have reason to push for changes in the law.
Our view has been there are a couple things that can be made better.
David Pettit is with the Natural Resources Defense Council. His group has been working with California legislators to modernize the law because there is some development that environmentalists do favor, like urban mass transit. He says residents in some of L.A.'s tonier neighborhoods have used CEQA to block a light rail project.
It's a great project, and I personally can't wait till it's finished.
Some of Pettit's green allies worry that business just wants to gut the law. Shiloh Ballard at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group says no, they just don't want developers intimidated by the mere threat of a CEQA lawsuit, like the builder in overpriced Palo Alto who built only 50 affordable housing units instead of 100.
Simply because they looked at the tea leaves and they said, you know what, we don't want to deal with the headache. We don't want to take the financial risk.
Even Governor Jerry Brown has called overhauling CEQA the Lord's work, and some say it'll take a miracle to get any changes passed before lawmakers adjourn on Friday. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Five long years.
Stocks all around the world are tanking.
Lehman Brothers had 26,000 some odd employees. And
somehow we just missed that home prices don't go up forever.
Crisis.
If you were in college 5 years ago or had just graduated when Lehman Brothers went down, the financial crisis probably felt a little bit like seeing your future evaporate right before your eyes. The thousands upon thousands of students who came out of school into one of the worst job markets in memory are this era's lost generation. Lost wages, lost promotions, lost opportunities. Things are starting to get back to normal with unemployment a bit lower and jobs opening up. But Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports that for the unlucky class of 08, what's gone may be gone for good.
I graduated in May of 2009.
I am 24, and I graduated in 2011.
I graduated in December of 2007.
Searching for a job back then was really tough.
You start out kind of optimistic, thinking, yeah, I'll totally get a job.
It feels kind of self-defeating sometimes.
I applied to over 300 individual positions.
You were lucky to get an interview.
It took me about, I guess, 7-8 months.
About 9 months.
A little more than a year and a half, about 2 years.
I don't think any of us expected when we went into college in 2005 that it would be so difficult.
That was Ben Bradley, Sydney Lynch, Alicia Weeks, Danielle Jaffe, and Julie Shetanikova. The good news is a few years on, all of them have found jobs of one sort or another. The bad news...
On average, young people that enter the labor market when job opportunities are so weak don't do well. They will, as a group, have lower wages, fewer opportunities than they otherwise would have.
Heidi Shierholz is a labor economist with the Economic Policy Institute, and she's not talking theoretically. Researchers have followed people who entered the job market during recessions in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. They start off making between 8 and 20% less.
Hi, this is Danielle.
Danielle Jaffe. University of Maryland, class of 09, business degree. After a year of interning for free, she got a job in international development.
I remember when my then manager was offering me the position, said the salary, he prefaced it with, you know, this is a little lower than we have in the past, but this is what we can offer you at this time. I was happy I had a job.
But that little bit can add up.
The negative impact of entering a labor market during a downturn can follow you for 1 to 2 decades.
That's Shierholz at EPI. And yeah, that's not just because you start out making less, but a lot of people start out below their skill level. You know, a paralegal instead of a lawyer. The underemployment rate for young college grads is 18%, twice what it was before the recession.
I actually went back into lifeguarding because I knew it was a job that I could get and I had rent to pay.
Alicia Weeks majored in poli-sci and fine arts at UC Santa Cruz. She graduated in 07. She was thinking congressional campaigns and art galleries, not sunblock.
It's been pretty hard emotionally. You have these ideas coming out of college of what your life is going to be like, and now you're doing the exact same thing you did before you went to college.
If this recession is like previous ones, Weeks and many others will eventually work their way up to the salaries they would be earning if they graduated during good times. But the earnings they've missed out on in the meantime?
these are really kind of permanent losses. This is the thing that always makes my undergraduates look really sad.
Abigail Wozniak is an economics professor at Notre Dame.
When we say they catch up, it means they just catch up to where they would have been if you'd started in a better period. It's not like you make up those 10 years of earning, you know, 10, 15, or 5% less than you would have been earning.
For some people, that could mean delaying a down payment on a house or waiting to get married. And for those taking the double hit of a lousy paying job and a boatload of student loan debt, it could mean years of struggling. The student loan default rate is now around 9%. Double what it was before the recession. But all is not lost for the so-called lost generation, says Till Van Wachter, an economist at Columbia University. To succeed, he says, they have to do what may seem like the hardest thing of all, keep trying and hold out until the right job comes along.
A, be patient, but also be an active job searcher.
He says jobs are coming back and will come back, and it's important for young people to stay mobile and flexible for as long as possible. Relocate, try something different.
If they settle too early, they settle with that lower quality job.
Even so, the pressure is on for recession grads. Now they're competing with yearly crops of new people who don't have huge blank spaces on their resume. According to the latest jobs data, the unemployment rate for 24-year-olds is still the slowest to recover. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's very hard to control people who are not on your payroll, whom you can't command.
College sports, believe it or not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 135 points today, about 0.9%, closed at 15,326. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ down 4 points, 0.1%, ended things at 3725. The S&P 500 up 5 points. 0.3%, plus or minus, closed at 1689. IBM clicked up 2.2% today. The world's biggest computer services provider agreed to sell its customer care outsourcing business to Synnex Corporation for $505 million. Synnex jumped 20% on that news. Surprise, surprise. Semiconductor maker Texas Instruments played 0.7% lower today after amending its forecast for quarterly earnings. Still with technology, Apple faded 5.4% today after analysts said the lower-cost iPhone wasn't really all that lower cost. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. A Senate subcommittee on primary health and aging discusses the cost of dental care. A look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for August. And a paper replica of Jacqueline Lee Bouvier's taffeta wedding gown goes on display at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum for the 60th anniversary of their wedding. The bride's original dress, too fragile for display. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. September the 15th is the day a lot of people use as the real, no kidding, start of the financial crisis when Lehman Brothers went under. There is a case to be made, though, that the actual point of no return was 10 days or so earlier when the Treasury Department took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the big government-backed mortgage companies. They did it to the tune of $188 billion in an effort to calm the housing market. Doug Duncan is the chief economist and a senior vice president as well at Fannie Mae. Doug, it's good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
First things first, I suppose, general thoughts on the state of the American housing market here in the five-year mark of Lehman Brothers and middle of 2013.
It's improving, but it's not robust. We have a ways to go before we can pronounce it robust. I think that's probably going to happen around the beginning of 2016.
Whoa, that's really far away.
Mm-hmm. So three more years.
Doesn't that just make you shake your head and go, this is still 5 years on, unbelievable?
Yeah. It's the biggest kind of event like this that we've had since World War II, or since the Depression, really.
Were you there in September 2008? Were you at Fannie Mae when Henry Paulson called your bosses into the office and said, we're taking you over?
I was.
What was that like?
It was stunning, no question. There was nothing in the history of the company to suggest that that was a likely probability. Although I joined the company in April, and the stock price was already dramatically declining. Yeah. And so you knew there were some fundamental problems. And, you know, I joined knowing that that was likely to be the case, but not conservatorship. That wasn't really the perception of how the problems would emerge.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got bailed out by the government. I don't know how you guys talk about it inside the shop, but outside the perception is you guys got bailed out by the government the same way the big banks did. And yet people are vitriolic still about the big banks, and you guys are kind of flying under the radar a little bit.
Well, not so much now that we've started reporting profits.
Mm-hmm.
And for us to get out of that, it requires legislative action. Our CEO was on record in the last couple of days saying it's time to fix it. We really need to get this moving and get repaired.
So what gives? If you want it and the Obama White House wants it, members of Congress want it.
Well, they all have to reach an agreement. We're not really part of that other than we answer questions based on data that we have that no one else has. We were by law prohibited from lobbying, so we can't really participate in that.
I was doing some reading before I came in to talk to you, and one of the things that struck me was that there are more people working at Fannie Mae now than there were before the crisis. You were like 5,800 before the crisis, 7,200 now. Just like the banks, you guys are getting bigger. How come?
Well, there was this thing about a crisis, which created several million households that were in default. And so working with them required some additional staffing. We were not staffed at a level that would allow us to manage that level of distressed properties. Making a mortgage and securitizing it is a lot less labor intensive than working with a consumer to figure out their real financial situation and whether you can help them once they're in trouble. That's very time intensive because it's a one-on-one transaction and it takes a significant time period. So a big part of that staffing increase has been to try to manage the distressed borrowers through the crisis.
Why does housing matter so much? Why is it so important in this economy?
Well, when I moved from my last job to this job, I thought about leaving the housing industry. But it occurs to me that people will always live on a structure built on land, somewhere in proximity to where they work in a structure built on land.
Okay.
So real estate is basic. The issue was that financing got out of kilter.
Are you a renter or a buyer?
I'm an owner.
There you go.
I rented for the first 40 years.
Did you really?
I did.
So why change your mind?
Paint
nice the walls
location.
And do whatever you want with the house?
That I also wanted to own a property on a river. I own a property living on a river. I love water. It's in some ways it's simple. You don't have somebody looking over your shoulder to see if you're taking care of the walls or, as you say, you can paint them, change them.
Doug Duncan, he is a senior vice president and the chief economist at Fannie Mae. Thanks a lot for coming in.
You bet. Thank you.
College football is back, and with it, stories about the seamy underbelly of college sports, this time at Oklahoma State University. Sports Illustrated says for at least a decade, OSU football players accepted cash and bogus jobs from university boosters. The school says it's investigating, but the simple word booster seems a bit of an understatement given just how much universities rely on those deep-pocketed fans. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
At big-time sports schools like the University of Oregon and Ohio State, boosters help pay for everything from scholarships and team travel to multi-million-dollar stadiums. Managing these generous superfans can be problematic.
It's very hard to control people who are not on your payroll, whom you can't command.
That's Charles Klotfelter, a professor at Duke University and author of the book Big Time Sports in American Universities. There are steps schools can take, he says, like keeping boosters out of the locker room. That's where some fat envelopes were allegedly handed out at Oklahoma State. Ellen Starowski teaches sport management at Drexel University. She says whenever big donors help bankroll athletics or academics, it raises questions.
Are we selling off the value system of higher education each time we enter into these kinds of agreements.
But Starowski says the underground economy in college sports wouldn't exist if players were fairly compensated to begin with. The average full scholarship, she says, falls well short of the full cost of college. Former UCLA linebacker Ramogi Humah started the National College Players Association after a teammate was suspended for accepting groceries from an agent.
I just question, you know, how is it that players can generate so much money and yet even the basic necessities can be hard to get?
An NCAA proposal to add a $2,000 stipend for athlete expenses has been delayed. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which corporate America still, somehow, 12 years later, just doesn't get it. Here with two of the many marketing failures tied to this date. Number one, Marriott, the hotel chain, has apologized for offering complimentary coffee and mini muffins, quote, in memory of those we lost on 9/11. Item number two, the golf course in Wisconsin, nine holes with a cart. Yep, $9.11. All right, that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM today. The Dow up 135 points, about 0.9%. The NASDAQ down 4 points, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 up 5 points, 0.3%. John Buckley, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.